You are listening to the Health Hack Podcast, powered by Lumen and hosted by myself, Caroline Pierce. As an athlete, sports scientist, and sports presenter, I am passionate about health and how we can unlock the skills to hack our full potential. Each episode, I'll be joined by a leader in the health and well-being world to learn how they've come to understand their body and turned that knowledge into power that could help you too. Today's guest is a popular physician and writer. He's the chief medical officer of WebMD and delivered award-winning programming on television shows for the Discovery Network. He's also just released his latest book, Take Control of Your Diabetes Risk. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. John White. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, it is great to be with you and to see you. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for my copy of the book and signed copy. And I've been reading this and revisiting it over the last few days. And I want us to get into that conversation about your book, because I feel it's not just for people with diabetes. There's just so much incredible information in there that we can all touch on to improve our health. But where did this passion for medicine and education come from? Because you're not just a physician, you're a writer. And, you know, on television, you deliver so much more information as well.
Well, I think it's a balance. I still see patients, not every day, but that reminds me always what's on people's minds. What are they thinking about? What are they fearful about? And I've always been interested in health and medicine. And as I've moved on in my career, I was interested in the patient in front of me, but also populations of patients. And how could I help provide good information? When it comes to, you know, writing prescription drugs, we have a good strategy in terms of how we do that. But when we talk about lifestyle, we often don't give patients good information. We say, you need to lose weight or you need to exercise. And over the years, I've heard from people say, tell me what to do. Where do I go for the right information? So that really was the goal in this book, to really curate the best information out there, put it in one source. And you and I were talking before we started that knowledge is power. Yeah. That if people have better information, they're going to have better health. And sadly, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So that was the goal, to give them information that's backed by science.
And you know what, in looking through the book, I love the way it's all this bite-sized information. It's really easy to digest. You've got the true, false little questionnaires that test your own knowledge. And, you know, you're touching on everything from diet, exercise, stress, sleep, all these important lifestyle factors. So why is the conversation around diabetes so important, and how prevalent is it in our society?
In the United States, it's 10% of the population. 1 in 10 have diabetes. Probably about 3 to 4 out of 10 have pre-diabetes. We're not getting better. We're actually getting worse. And I'm primarily talking about type 2 diabetes, which is 90% of it is caused by lifestyle. And in some ways, the more that countries become developed, they have a greater incidence of diabetes. Because what happens? You're not working as part of your job more. You're sitting at a desk. You're eating high processed foods, which contribute to high blood sugars. So in some ways, a success in a weird way of, you know, economic power is an increase in obesity. And all too often, people think it's genetic, one way or the other, meaning they'll come to me and they'll say, well, my mother has diabetes, my grandfather has diabetes, you know, I'm going to get diabetes. So, you know, what can I do? Or they say, no one in my family has diabetes, so I'm not at risk. But genetics plays a really small role. And even when it does, there's been these fascinating studies lately that have shown it's probably not the genes, the inherited mutations, but it's probably about shared lifestyles. You grew up in a family that, you know, focused on clean your plate and, you know, lots of servings. So you're used to eating a lot. You might be a snacker in your family where there's a lot of cookies and cakes. So you learned those behaviors. So it's not genetic, but it's really that shared lifestyle. And this is a reminder to people, you can in many ways control where you are in your health. It's not easy. Nothing's 100% preventable. But it's all about reducing risk and maximizing health.
Well, that's interesting as well, because it's almost better that it's lifestyle, more lifestyle linked.
It is. We can do something about it. Yeah. Yeah. That's the good news in a way. It's good news, bad news.
We have control. And with that knowledge, we have the power, as you said. Just to sort of, for people's understanding, what are the different types of diabetes? Let's just sort of set those out from the beginning on which ones we're going to be talking about with regard to these lifestyle factors.
And I always tell people diabetes is really about energy balance, right? We eat food, we break it down into glucose, and then we absorb glucose through insulin released by our pancreas into our cells. And we use that glucose for energy. And if we don't need that energy, we store it as glycogen in the liver and elsewhere. So in type 1 diabetes, that's known as insulin deficiency. Your pancreas doesn't make enough insulin. So that's why we usually see it early in life, because your pancreas isn't producing it and you're going to exhibit those symptoms. There are some variants which we can see later in life, but you're going to need insulin to live. That's not that many people. Type 2 diabetes is known as insulin resistant. So your pancreas still makes insulin. And early on in type 2 diabetes, it ends up making more insulin because your cells have become resistant. They're not responding to the insulin. I've been saying to people, it's kind of like your cell phone charger when it's no longer working and you plug it into your phone and it's not charging and you wake up one morning and you're, this happened to me. It's not responding to the charge. That's type 2 diabetes. And 90% of that is relating to our weight.
Well, let's move on to diet then, because I feel like that's a huge contributing factor. And in your book, you've got these sort of true, false kind of questions. And I want to use that to ask you a few questions. And the first one is, can eating too much sugar cause diabetes?
And this is where there's a myth that if you eat a lot of sugar, that causes diabetes, and too much sugar causes diabetes. That's not completely accurate. It's about weight. So if I changed all the sugary foods I ate and changed it to all fatty foods, and ate a lot of them, I still could get diabetes because I'm going to gain weight, and that's going to impact how my cells respond to insulin. Sugar certainly plays a key role, and we eat way too many carbohydrates, and we eat the bad carbs too much, which we call the simple carbs, which are the cakes and the cookies and the processed cereals that we think are healthy because they say fruit in them, but they're fruit flavored when you look closely, or the instant oatmeals and things. And then our sugar goes way up, and then it goes way down, and then we're hungry again and we eat. So it's not sugar per se that's the only culprit. It plays a big role, but it's really about patterns of eating and even timing of eating as well.
So these, when you say we think we're eating healthy foods with these cereals and sort of a lot of artificial sweeteners, and often we think, oh, there's no sugar in it, but there's all these artificial sweeteners. So again, another one of your questions were, can artificial sweeteners help you to lose weight? I'm going to let you answer that one.
And I think we all know folks who use artificial sweeteners and still gain weight. And we all joke about, we get a hamburger and fries, and then we get that diet soda, because it all balances out. And there's a couple reasons why studies have consistently shown that people still gain weight using artificial sweeteners. One is that you often overestimate the benefit that you've gotten, right? So, I didn't drink, a soda, so now I can eat, this donut, or I can eat, this other unhealthy food because it's a switch. And it's really not. And the other thing, from a physiologic basis, these artificial sweeteners, some of them are 10 times, 100 times as sweet as sugar. And it tricks your body, because your body's thinking, I'm going to get this sugar load. And then you don't. So what happens? You start to crave some of those sugary foods. So that's why then you might not have sugary soda, but then you're going to get a candy bar or a cookie, because your body is craving that.
So we're tricking our body.
We are. And there's consequences. And what happens is you often still gain weight.
So in terms of different types of diet, we've got the ketogenic, the keto diet. When you think about diabetes, a lot of us might think, well, ketogenic might be a good option because you're essentially eliminating, the carbohydrates, the sugars. You said we eat too many of them. Can it be? Can the keto diet be suitable for diabetics or preventing diabetes?
I think there is a role in the ketogenic diet. The issue is you have to be consistent in your following of the diet, and you have to be informed as to how to do it right. What I often tell people, I wish they would focus more on patterns of eating. What happens is, and it's starting to happen now, weather's getting warmer, summer's going to be approaching, people want to lose weight for summer. And they're only going to change their behavior for a certain period of time to lose weight. And then they resume their old habits. So if you can do keto diet and follow it because you like that style of eating for a lifetime, that's great. because you're going to keep that weight off. Whereas other people, I'm like, it's about a pattern of eating. So maybe you start, because you don't want to make too many changes at once. And you say, and I talk about this in the book, maybe you just start making sure you eat fruit every day. Every day. Most of us don't. Most of us don't eat vegetables every day. So even if you start adding things in, right, and then you start removing other things, and it is about, at the end of the day, eating more fish. Only 20% of people eat fish once a week. The rest eat none. It's not like 80% of you. So even if you replaced some of those processed meats, those red meats, with fish once or twice a week, you're automatically going to lose weight because it's lower in calories, and then it's chock full of vitamins and minerals and antioxidants. If you started to eat more green leafy vegetables, your cholesterol is going to improve. You're going to feel more full. But people don't want to think about it that way. And I say to people consistently, you know, I'm not as interested where you are 6 months from now. I want to know where you're going to be 2 years from now, 3 years from now, because most of your friends are going to have gained weight. Just the natural process of aging and, you know, our decreased energy output. So if you lose half a pound a month, right? And no one thinks that seems like a lot, but I'm like, if you do that consistently, think where you're going to be 3 years from now, 5 years from now, when all your friends are going to be 20, 30 pounds heavier, you're going to be 20 or 30 pounds lighter.
I think a lot of us don't think that far ahead. We want that pound a week. We want to embark on this drastic dietary change.
They went two pounds
a week. I know. But you're saying it's really a small changes that can make a difference in terms of preventative health, our weight, all those things. And talking of eating patterns, you said, you know, eating patterns, fasting is a pattern of eating or not eating at certain times. And I know you talk about this in the book as well, the different types of fasting and whether that can be beneficial for our health in general or for preventing pre-diabetes or curing diabetes, whatever that might be. How does fasting sort of play into our health and what's the best way to do it?
I've been doing intermittent fasting and my wife has as well. And a lot of times it helps when other people in your household adopt the same behaviors that you are. Otherwise becomes...
Meal times are a nightmare.
I think intermittent fasting can help in a few ways. One is because there's different ways that you do it. I mean, we do it that, you know, you compress everything either in an 8-hour time frame that you're going to eat, or you compress it in terms of how you're looking also on a several day basis. So there are several things that you can do, whether you do daily, 2 or 3 times a week. And I talk about, as you say in the book, what are these different styles? But part of it is also that you're not consuming as many calories. That's one of the biggest ways I think people are automatically losing weight, because I know I've been snacking a lot at night and isn't a good thing. But if you're doing intermittent fasting, you're not eating perhaps after 5 p.m. You're consuming fewer calories. You're focused a little more on your health in general. Those are probably the biggest changes because of the time course of your eating. And for some people, it's also they just need a reset. And I find that it's useful for me. So I'm not able to do it every day. That I just, you know, feel like I don't know if I could do that. I have young kids, so there's all sorts of eating challenges. But a lot of times, you know, we try to do it twice a week. And then it's a great reset to think, okay, I'm restarting the next day. And I'm going to try eating a little healthier. I'm going to be more conscious of what I'm putting in my mouth. It's getting that feedback on a scale on those weeks of intermittent fasting where, you know, maybe I've lost a pound this month. And that's pretty good because I had been gaining in terms of reversing or curing diabetes. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd say there's no way we can cure or even reverse type 2 diabetes. Because as you know, we felt once the time you're diagnosed, 50% of your beta cells, those are cells of the pancreas that produce insulin, have burned out. They're done. But recent research has suggested that they may be able to regenerate, at least regain function. So that means you can potentially reverse diabetes and certainly pre-diabetes. You have to act early and you have to do these lifestyle changes. Sometimes I tell people it's more like remission if we use kind of the cancer point that we can put diabetes in remission. What's been fascinating is studies have consistently shown it's about 7% of your body weight. So for many people, that's 20, 25 pounds. It's not this huge amount of weight that people think they need to lose to reduce prediabetes, or at least prevent its progression and reverse diabetes. So that's what I'm excited about, to empower people to say, you do have the power. Sure, some people are going to need to be on medicine for a variety of reasons, but you might be able to decrease your dose. You might be able to come off of it. And all too often, doctors are not good about it. I'm not going to spend the time to talk to you. I mean, I do, but a lot of doctors, I'm not going to spend the time to talk to you about lifestyle because I don't know if it's going to work. And I don't think you can do it. You know, there's some biases that exist. And, you know, sometimes patients don't want to make the changes. All too often, I see people that start insulin that then adjust their insulin based on eating sugary stuff. And they're like, oh, well, I can just change my insulin. I'm like, no, that's not the right approach.
It seems crazy because the cost of medication in the United States anyway, why would you not want to do something to bring you off of that medication, off those costs? And I like that idea as well of just resetting your system. And I think when we embark on these ways of eating, you think that that's it for life, ketogenic for life, fasting for life. How could I possibly do it? And before you know it, you've stopped. You know, you're back onto eating your sugary food. So I like that idea of resetting. Just picking up on what you said about you. So you do an early fasting window when you do it, which was interesting to me because the way I've done it, and I've, you know, sort of seen other people do it, is that you just skip the breakfast and you start that eating later and you eat until later. What's the benefit of the earlier fasting window if that's what you choose?
Because
to do?
I'm not eating calories later at night. That's the bigger
when you're issue. Sluggish in your metabolism.
Yeah. And I've been snacking at night and I want to change that. But you know, my other pet peeve, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is this kind of belief by many people that eating healthy and or living, you know, a healthy lifestyle and being happy are mutually exclusive. Like, oh, I'm gonna have to have
a vegetable or
yes, I'm going to have to eat fruit, or oh, I'm going to have to go for a walk. Those aren't bad things and don't make you feel bad. I always say to people, how do you feel after you worked out or went on a run? Do you ever say, oh, I wish I didn't do that? Like, I wish
what do they say? The only bad workout's the one you didn't do, or you never regret a workout. You know, it's true.
You say, I feel great. You really do. And you're glad you did it. You know, eat a healthy breakfast and see how you feel 2 hours versus, you know, the processed cereals that you eat. And then you're wondering why an hour and a half later, you're hungry again. You can eat fruits and vegetables. You can eat fish. And, you know, food is very much an acquired taste. And I have people say, I don't like fish. I have in the book, it's a true story, how, you know, I say this patient, like, you know, if you lost weight, you know, you could come off your medicines. I like, you know, you could start eating fish. She's like, I don't like fish. And I offer all these choices. And I said, and you need to drink water. And she actually said to me, I don't like water. And I know what she meant.
This is what my dad says. I try and get my dad to drink water. He's like, I wash in water. I don't drink water. And he'd rather just have a cup of tea. So it's hilarious to me. You know, I'm like, you're so dehydrated. He's like, oh, I just have a cup of tea or a coffee. It's like, no.
But you have to try things and get there. And, you know, you think about it where I did used to drink soda. And then, you know, I switched to diet soda and then I switched to sparkling water. And now I'm like, I don't have a desire for soda.
Squeeze of lemon or lime.
I'm not sacrificing anything. And I think people think, oh, I can't live then without a morning soda. I know people that drank morning soda because they're like, that's better than coffee. I'm like, it's not actually at all.
Well, that comes down to there being a lot of false information out there as well. And, you know, again, going back to my dad, he'd come back from his guitar shop or Barry the guitarist said that this is what he does to lose weight. I'm like, Dad, I've studied this. This is not what you do. So I think we believe what we want to believe, but nutritional foods come such a long way from food, healthy food being boring. I mean, God, you can make these beautiful breakfast bowls, which are delicious. And I look forward to them in the morning, or my smoothie in the morning with all the goodness, but tasty things in it. So I think it's just education again, isn't it? And not seeing exercise and diet as punishment. But as a general, what are the general rules with diets, like the do's and the don'ts? Like you've touched obviously on the soda and the candy and whatever, but what are sort of briefly are the do's and don'ts of diet?
It is as important what you include as well as what you exclude. So that's, you know, very important that you talk about it. We do want to stop as much of the red meat, the processed meats, the salamis, the cured meats, pastrami's. a lot of sodium. Sodium is also a problem even with diabetes. A lot of the unhealthy fats. It's a lot of the processed foods, the white bread, the white rice, the cookies, the pastries. We know that alcohol is not good for your body. Mm. Many years ago, we thought, you know, red wine and resveratrol could be a value. The data hasn't shown that.
Oh, so that's no longer the case, because I think a lot of people held on to that.
I know. They're still trying to hold on to it. You know, that doesn't mean that you can't have an occasional, you know, alcohol, but you can't be having it every day. You can't be having it, you know, three times a week. We really need to decrease that. But again, yeah. It's not about denial that you can never have anything. It's about things in moderation. You know, on the healthy side, it is about consuming more fish, as we talked about, consuming more whole grains. Certainly, if you have celiac disease and can't process gluten, then that doesn't work. But the reality is, I have patients that are like, oh, should I go gluten-free? And I'm like, you don't have celiac disease. The problem with some of those gluten-free products is they take out the wheat, but they fill it with more carbs. So gluten-free pasta can have way more carbs than regular pasta. So a lot of mislabeling.
I think we see signs or labels such as vegan, gluten-free, and we immediately assume it's healthy.
Fat-free. I used to post this picture of, do you know these Swedish fish, these red candies?
Oh, yeah. You get them in Trader Joe's.
Yes, that's it. So they're packaged, if you look at labeling, fat-free. Now, come on, we know it's all, of course, they're fat-free. They're all sugar. but doesn't that sound healthy? Like these are fat-free.
Yeah.
It is about drinking more water, especially in lieu of other beverages where we get a lot of calories through drinking them. And people don't think about that. I tell people all the time, replace every beverage you have with water. You will lose weight in the next few weeks. It is about more fruits and vegetables, as we talked about, that most of us don't consume on a daily basis. And I ask people all the time, tell me the last vegetable you have. And they have to go back like 2 weeks or something. You know, 70 to 80% of Americans eat fast food at least 3 to 4 times a week.
That's a huge number. And not only that, the vegetables we do eat nowadays are quite devoid of the nutrients they were sort of back in the day. So we almost need more, don't we? Which kind of begs the question as well of how, the importance of maybe supplementation with regard to this as well. How important is that?
I'm not a huge fan of supplementation. Yeah. Full disclosure, I worked at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration mm-hmm. for a long time. Supplements are regulated as a food as opposed to a drug. So the way it works, you don't have to prove your claim before you come to market. So you can say certain things and don't have to have the data to support it. It's the reverse for drugs. Where I think supplements can help is if people have nutritional deficiencies, such as vitamin D. This goes to your point, to when everyone has misinformation, people will say to me, my neighbor says, Dr. White, I should be on such and such. It's always like vitamin D. And I'll be like, you're not vitamin D deficient. So there's really only value in terms of vitamin D supplementation if you're vitamin D deficient. You know, there's been back and forth data about the role of omega-3 fatty acids in terms of heart disease prevention, stroke prevention, diabetes prevention. You know, if you really can't eat fish, there's probably some role for omega-3 fatty acids. There's some preliminary data about chromium and alpha-lipoic acid for those people that have diabetes that's poorly controlled that may be able to help in insulin sensitivity. So remember, we talked about insulin resistance as type 2 diabetes. If I can improve that sensitivity to insulin, that's going to help. That's actually what exercise does. That's why exercise is as close to a magic pill. It improves insulin sensitivity. So supplementation can help here and there. But I tell people all the time, you don't need a multivitamin if you eat a healthy diet. And we don't want to have an excuse to say, well, I can get it in a supplement. What I also tell people that I'm more interested in, and I talk about it in the book, is spices, right? We've known for thousands of years the medicinal purposes of spices. Garlic, turmeric. There's a lot of value to spices, and they actually can help flavor your food tremendously. So I'd rather people focus on spices rather than supplements, because even how you digest a pill and absorb a pill isn't going to be exactly the same if you've got it it is close to its natural form in whole foods.
That's quite eye-opening. Yeah, that's quite eye-opening, actually, because I think we do just go to the supplements and we're so bombarded with everything we should be taking. I mean, I rattle in the mornings. I'm probably taking so many supplements. So it's a good thing to know. So moving on to exercise, because you said, you know, the power of exercise, and you talk about the difference between physical activity and exercise and the mindset behind that. So break that down for us as well, because they're two quite different things, aren't they?
That's exactly right. And exercise really is this structured program where you often have a goal to build muscle or lose weight, but it's structured. You've chosen an activity. Whereas physical activity, you know, is really our activities of daily living. A lot of people will say to me, this is pre-pandemic, oh, I don't need to exercise. I walk around a lot at work. And I'm like, that doesn't count. You know, in exercise, the key is for diabetes prevention or cancer prevention, it's really about elevating your heart rate. It's really about sweating a little and intensity. And activity isn't going to give you as much of that benefit. The struggle is many of the specialty groups recommend 150 minutes of exercise a week. And at first, that can be very challenging for a lot of folks, especially when you're working two jobs or you have young children or you're a caregiver. But what data has recently shown is you can exercise smarter, not longer. The role of high intensity in terms of power walking. So instead of doing an hour walk, go on a 10-minute power walk where one foot's on the ground at all times, but you're going about 3 miles per hour. You're sweating. You're not going to engage in that leisurely stroll with your neighbor, which is good socially, but then you're like, why am I losing weight? Because you're not stressing your body in a good way to get that benefit. There was a study done, and it's been, you know, duplicated. 4 minutes of exercise, 30 seconds of high intensity, followed by 30 seconds of rest, repeating that 4 times, that's 4 minutes, doing it 4 times a week. So you actually have to do it 4 times a week. That's a total of 16 minutes. They studied over 100,000 people doing this. Their blood sugars came back to normal.
Wow. I think I've heard of that, actually. It's sort of similar to Tabata style as well, that was
popular
at one time.
But you have to do it. I mean, you have to do it, and you do have to sweat, and that's not for everyone. But the point is, you have to have, and I talk about in the book, like a love affair with exercise. You have to want to do it. It can't be seen as a chore. So you have to choose those activities as part of an exercise program that you're going to want to do. Yeah. And the challenge is, it's not like if our blood sugar is high, we get an alarm, so to speak, our body telling us, oh, hey, because you're urinating a lot or eating a lot. You know, exercise doesn't send us an alarm like, hey, hello, it's, you know, it's your body saying you have to exercise. And that's a challenge. And sometimes people are fearful, like, I don't know what to do. You know, people will say to me, and we laugh, and I know what they mean. They're like, I've got to get in shape to go to the gym. And I'll be like, what?
I've heard that too.
And I come up with the excuses like, oh, like, you know, I'm not dressed. I don't feel like changing. Like,
is there a case where if you have pre-diabetes or diabetes where too much exercise can have a detrimental effect?
You know, in general, you know, you have to do exercise right. So there is a risk of harm. People that have poorly controlled diabetes, especially if they're on insulin, have to be very careful in terms of exercise, because that could bottom out your blood sugar, make it too low. But for most people, we're not exercising too much. That's a very small percentage. Yeah. There's the risk of injury. There's the risk of low blood sugar if you have poorly controlled diabetes. But most people aren't going to be down that route of too much exercise.
It's all, like we say, about education, but also about accountability and feedback for your body. And we talk about tracking devices, and we were talking sort of off camera about this as well. And Lumen, the sponsor of our podcast, is an absolutely fantastic and very highly scientific device that uses our breath to tell us the energy that we're using, the fats, the carbohydrates, the protein. How beneficial is that? Because I know you're a friend of Lumen and an advisor as well. How beneficial is that to informing us on what we should eat if we're in that position where we say, I don't know what to eat. I don't know what exercise to do. How does that help?
I'm amazed at the innovation that we've had over the last few years. And as you know, I'm a huge supporter of these devices and types of devices, because fundamentally people want to know, as you just pointed out, what do I do? How does my body respond? What do I eat? And what these devices, Lumen and other ones you mentioned, they're giving me my body's response. So I'll give you my own example. And as you know, I've been using it because I want that feedback. I know I've been eating too many snacks at night. My kids are watching movies. We're eating popcorn. I know that's not good. And I'll say, like, I'm not eating after 7, but I do. But when I've been tracking it with Lumen, I know whether I'm burning fat or carbs in the morning. And I know I'm supposed to be burning fat. And when I get those days when I see I'm burning fat, it's not a coincidence when I look at the end of the week that I've lost weight, right? We think about an exercise. When you asked, are there dangers of exercising too much? I can use a device like Lumen, and I can utilize it before I exercise. So I know, do I need a snack beforehand? Before I had to guess, but I can tell based on my body. And there's other devices that give other type of information. I'm a big proponent that we should be utilizing this information because it's feedback for people that I can do on a daily basis. You know, I don't recommend that people do it, you know, 8, 7, 8 times a day to find, because some of us can become too preoccupied by numbers. But even where I see these tools iterating is in terms of helping educate, okay, here are the numbers. How does what I eat tell me what to eat? So I see you've all been utilizing in terms of, here's a nutrition advice I can give you. Here are options. What I love that everyone's doing, here are recipes. Everybody loves recipes nowadays. I think that's been during the—
There's some great ones in your book as well.
And I've been doing them, and I have a bunch in there. I have one that I didn't put in there, which are these oat cakes where I just use oatmeal, smashed banana, and cinnamon. I'm like, there is no sugar in this. But the point again about these devices are, it tells you your information. So we really have to come to this recognition for prediabetes, diabetes, and all health conditions. Health is what happens when you leave the doctor's office. I'm less concerned about your blood sugar in the doctor's office, your blood pressure in the doctor's office. Sure, it matters. But what really matters is what you're doing at home. What really matters are, what are your measurements on a daily basis? And it's great that I can look at trends. I can look at analysis. I can look at recommendations for me. That's where we need to be moving when we talk about, how do you take control of your healthcare? How do you maximize your health? At the end of the day, and COVID has taught us that, all we have is our health. Sure, our jobs are important, but we need our health. And you can see I'm passionate about this.
Yeah.
Before I met all of you. If we can use these tools and we can use these devices that are based on science and are doing trials and studies to help guide us to make the right decisions, then that helps. And you can say, yeah, of course I know eating late at night is not good for me. But when I can actually see the next morning how my body is metabolizing carbs and fat, that's incredibly useful. When I can see on days after I exercise, it seems to have, you know, more blood sugar control, where I can look over time and map my weight in terms of how my body's utilizing carbs or fat, that's valuable. And that's going to drive behavior.
It's that personalized approach, isn't it? Because we're not all the same. We're all different. And something we also need is sleep, more sleep. I mean, you say as well, we're living in this sleep epidemic. And I think we almost glamorize this idea of, oh, I only 4 hours sleep and I crushed the day. All right. You know,
absolutely. It's a badge of honor. And who really feels good after sleep, not having sleep? No one really feels good. And I say to people, would you want an airline pilot, you know, to say on the plane before the plane, oh, you know, I did an all-nighter, you know, thanks for coming on board? No, because
you're
going to know that way. But there's a physiological reason why poor sleep is so bad. And it's really that circadian rhythm, that 24-hour clock of our body. And it's the release of hormones. So we could say, oh, well, you need sleep. Okay. But the physiologic reason for blood sugar control is because it messes up our cortisol levels, our melatonin, our orexin. So high cortisol levels are going to raise blood sugar. So if I can't control my cortisol levels, which should naturally, you know, be lower at night and higher in the morning, if they're high throughout the day, that's going to be bad in terms of these elevated blood sugars. So there's a physiologic reason. You know, it's the role of stress too that we've talked about, which at the end of the day, chronic stress is chronic inflammation. We've learned that over the last few years. Inflammation is bad. for our body. So it's not just we're just saying these things, oh, it's great to, you know, have sleep. Yeah. There's physiologic reasons why it increases our risk for diabetes, why it increases our risk for cancer.
It increases when you haven't slept. You're quite ravenous, aren't you, in the morning? Your hunger, and there's a hormonal reason for that, right? What is it? Ghrelin.
Right. So hormone. There are these two hormones, leptin and ghrelin, that get messed up, and one makes us feel full, right? And the other one, makes us hungry. So lack of sleep messes up these hormones. And when we should be feeling full, we're feeling hungry. And we've seen that in terms of when folks have bariatric surgery, it kind of readjusts that leptin and ghrelin. Right. So you're exactly right. There's a hormonal reason why that's the case.
So the key question is, how do we get more sleep and better quality of sleep? And I know you talk about sort of cognitive behavioral therapy as well. And you've got some interesting methods that you talk about. What are they?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is not something that clinicians typically focus on, but it's really about retraining your mind in terms of how you think through sleep. And I tell people it's not going to change overnight, but it's probably the best investment of your time to improve your sleep in the long run. And, you know, I go over some issues, even from the idea of we really don't quiet our minds at night. We do emails at night. And let's be honest, we all get a little agitated and we prime our brains when we're doing emails. We don't quiet our brain, and we really need to do that. And I talk about even, you know, in the book about wearing socks and, you know, some other strategy keeping.
Oh, pets as well. You talk about it's actually good.
Pets are good.
Pets on the bed. I like that.
But it's also about keeping your room quiet and dark. And on the cooler side, I know that's always a debate with people, but cooler is better. But it's really making that investment in what we call sleep hygiene. I'll tell you, in 25 years of practicing as a physician, I probably have prescribed sleeping pills twice because right. I know that the long-term issues are often significant and people can't come off of them. They don't get restful sleep. And we have to change the mindset of how we view sleep and less, as you said, that badge of honor, less of, you know, everyone has heard this, oh, I'll sleep when I die. Well, you're going to die sooner, perhaps, if you have lack of sleep. And it's not an easy fix when people start to develop chronic insomnia. And sometimes poor sleep is a sign of underlying disease. Sometimes it is because of diabetes. Sometimes it's because of medications that we don't spend enough time, you know, talking about to our pharmacists, talking about to our doctors. But we need to put a greater focus on that. You know, it ties into the bigger issue that I mentioned in, you know, take control of your diabetes risk. There's no physical health without mental health. And we don't always make that mind-body connection. So of course, what we eat is critical. Food is medicine. Of course, the amount of physical activity and exercise we do play an enormous role in energy balance. But so do these other aspects in terms of lack of sleep, which can often be underlying mental health issues, you know, chronic stress. We need to recognize that connection.
I like the quietening your mind element as well, because I think we go through the day and as soon as your head hits the pillow and it's quiet, all these issues are going through your mind. What I've got to do? What I've got to, you know, I keep a notepad by my bed sometimes so I can just mind dump that information and get it out of my head.
You know, but you know, I tell people, and I was like this, I've changed this. The end of the day, when we're ready to go to sleep, is not the time to review our day and review our life. And I put in the book how some people have suggested, even especially for people that are anxious a lot, you always do it at the end of the night. Say at a time, 3 o'clock every day for 15 minutes, you're going to have all your anxious thoughts and spell them out because you're rewiring your brain to say, you know what? I'm going to do this at this time of day. And then at nighttime, you're not. So, you know, how many of us say, let me fire off one more text. Let me fire off one more email. And then Arianna Huffington, who is a good friend, she says to me, she puts her phone in the closet. I'm like, she's like, it was really, really hard. You know, the first few days, like wanted to get up in the middle of the night and go get it. But, you know, nothing's really that important on our phone.
I'd spend the next morning not knowing where it is. I'd be like, I've got to start my work. Where's my phone gone? But it's not a bad idea. Maybe I should try that. And another factor sort of coming back to sort of the diet is, what about caffeine and alcohol, the effect on our sleep? Because we talk about it in terms of moderation for day-to-day life. That's acceptable. But how late should we, or early should we stop our caffeine or caffeinated beverages?
For most people, for caffeine, coffee, which we do know has some health benefit, typically, you know, no more than 2 to 3 cups a day. For most people, it's usually 2 or 3 in the afternoon. But, you know, it depends on everyone. And I learned it. I used to, you know, drink coffee after dinner. Maybe I thought I was European. But then I realized as I got older, it was keeping me up at night. So now I don't do that. Or I do decaf. And I don't drink coffee after 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And that's usually the case for most people. Alcohol is not helpful for sleep. People initially think it is, but it
decreases. Well, that's it. Yeah, people think they have a little tipple and a bit of whiskey and it'll help them sleep.
It actually decreases your amount of REM sleep, which is that deep sleep, which is what we want. And people usually aren't as restful after a night with alcohol. So it does not help in terms of helping us go to sleep.
Explain what the REM sleep is, because I have a device that monitors my sleep and I get sleep, good sleep. I never get enough REM.
Yeah. And we've learned through tracking about, you know, the importance of the quality of sleep. So there is, you know, this rapid eye movement of sleep. That's what REM stands for. And it's really that deep sleep where we dream as well. But it's that restful, restorative sleep that we need. As we get older, in general, we have less REM sleep, but it's still important to have deep, restful sleep. So that's what we're looking at. And again, in the past, we'd have to go to sleep labs to get this kind of information, which never made sense to me. You're sleeping in a different place. You got all these kind of monitors on you. And now through wearables and other devices, we can see the quality of our sleep. And then back to, you know, what you mentioned about our tracking devices and other tools, we can make those correlations.
Well, the last thing I just want to touch on before I let you go, I mean, I've got a mind full of information now, I've learned so much from you already, is to touch on stress a little bit more. Yeah. And this stress response. And firstly, like identifying it. How do we identify if we're stressed? Because I think we can often attribute it to other things and not really recognize what the problem is.
And we all have different episodes of stress in our life. That's a normal part of living. And there's a physiologic response in terms of, you know, the historic fight or flight where, you know, we have release of norepinephrine, epinephrine, sometimes called adrenaline and other things that help us escape or fight if we need to. The issue is chronic stress, that daily feeling of you have stomach discomfort, you have headaches, that you have palpitations. That's the problem that we have, because it goes back to this issue of stress is really a disease of inflammation. Our cells basically have a process of inflammation where they don't work as well. Think about when you're stressed, you often make mistakes, right? If you're very stressed at work, you do something, then it's going to be a problem. There's this old, like, I Love Lucy, people are too old, but basically it was like, you know, if you're starting to make, you know, cakes or cookies or brownies, and then all of a sudden the machinery goes up, you're going to start making mistakes. Or we had a birthday party for one of my younger children, and I decided I was going to make these oat cookies that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. I was like, well, I can whip them up real fast. But instead of only making, like, you know, 12 that I needed to make 40 in a quick period of time. And some of them didn't look so good or whatever because I was rushed and stressed. And the great thing about 6-year-olds, they'll say things like, these don't look like cookies. These aren't good. I'm like, they're fine. But think what's happening to your cells at a cellular level. If there's chronic stress, your cells are going to make mistakes. That's what happens with cancer. And that's what cancer is, you know, really a disease of cell errors. That's what we're going to see in diabetes. Our cells aren't going to respond to insulin. When we have reproduction of cells, more of them are going to make mistakes. That's why chronic stress is so important to address, because it's mistakes happening at a cellular level, which puts us at risk of disease. And it goes to that point. There's no health without recognizing the mind-body connection. And all too often we ignore it, or we see it in others and we don't see it in ourselves. And I've been a big proponent of, you know, there's a lot of online surveys that people can use for anxiety. It's called the GAD-7, the Generalized Anxiety Disorder Scale 7. There's the PHQ-9 or PHQ-2, which help to diagnose depression. Tools for yourself or for others, you know, can help recognize that you may need a little help.
God, it's all such fascinating information. And so much of this is in your book. Let us know, John, where can people find the book?
Purchase it anywhere at any of the online stores, as well as your local bookseller as well. There's still some local booksellers. So it's always good to support them as well.
There is. Love it. Well, thank you so much. And go check out John's book, Take Control of Your Diabetes Risk. For more information, where can people find you? Do you have online, social media?
Sure, they can follow me on social at Dr. John White, which is my name, as well certainly at WebMD.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure
Thanks
talking to you.
Me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to the Health Hack Podcast with myself, Caroline Pierce. Each episode provides a healthy dose of health hacking. So make sure to hit subscribe or follow so you don't miss out. I would be truly grateful if you could rate and review wherever you're listening to help others seek inspiring stories and health hacks to find us. The Health Hack is an Insanity podcast production and powered by Lumen. See you next time.